Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. I suppose we should really start with a big ho, 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 everybody.
Well, you're good at ho, ho, ho anyway.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah, you're good at Santa.
On Christmas Eve next, we'll be talking to Santa live from the North Pole. So if you've sent in letters and emails and cards, stay by your radio on RT Radio 1 on Christmas Eve afternoon and Santa may read out your email. Thank you very much indeed, Aina, for allowing me to do that plug. In studio, Aina Land and Niall Hatch and Richard Collins. And we're joined by journalist Philip O'Connor, who lives in Sweden, but he's actually from Ireland and he's here at the moment. Philip, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much. Indeed, it's great to be here all together.
It's great to have you. So just 3 days to go to Christmas from tonight. So tell us about Christmas, first of all, in Sweden. What's it like?
Oh, God. It's the first time I celebrated Christmas in Sweden was in 1996. I remember getting off the airport and my then girlfriend, who's now my wife, you know, we got into our dad's car and it was like driving through a Christmas card. Mm. And she's from a little village about 60 kilometres north of Stockholm. And I used to smoke at that time and I'm glad I've given up since then. But I remember going out of the house at night and a reindeer just walking up the street. I thought, you people are having me on here, you know. But it was fantastic. The traditions are sort of quite different. They're more sort of central Northern European, you know. They celebrate on Christmas Eve more so than Christmas Day. So the big man comes on Christmas Eve. You do one of the last interviews with him before he starts making the rounds there.
Yes, we do. Yeah.
So it's fantastic altogether.
Wait a second now. So all the children open up their presents on Christmas Eve, do they?
Oh, Santa hands them over personally. You see, because they're an hour ahead. You see, so the way the time works and that kind of thing, he visits everywhere and then he comes further west and further west and further west from Europe and into America.
Oh yeah, as soon as it's time o'clock, he heads off on his journey around the world.
So one of the last things he does there, I work as a freelance journalist, and the last story I do is around about the same time as you interview him. He does a little video thing where he comes out and he says hello to everybody, wishes all the children in the world a Merry Christmas, just drops in 5-10 minutes, hands everything out, gone on to the next one, you know.
That's fantastic. You have a beard like Santa, by the way.
Well, I'm starting to get to that age,
but you're
all right.
Too thin.
That's all fixed up with the bags of stuff under your jumper.
Ask me again in January about the thinness is all I'll say, you know.
Bags of stuff under your jumper. Anyway, you're here to talk about nature.
Yes.
We came across some nature stories in Sweden and we thought, who best to get only Philip and he can tell us all about them. Are they true or not? So off you go. Which is first?
Well, the first one we had was, there was a company that was set up that was using corvids to clean up the streets. Now, the idea was that they were trained to pick up in particular cigarette butts, and they would bring them to these sort of automatic dispensers, and when they popped in a cigarette butt, then they would be given a treat. And of course these fellas aren't as green as they are cabbage looking. They learned very, very quickly that that this could be done, and they were getting it. But the problem was, anytime you tried to take something like that that's natural between an animal and a human or an animal in the environment or that, and you tried to convert it into money, unfortunately, when we started talking about this story, the company that was doing this went bankrupt.
Oh,
in
dear.
October they filed for bankruptcy. But it was a great idea and it generated a great debate in Sweden about, okay, how can we work with nature to preserve nature? And that was one of those ideas, okay, because the Swedes and the Norwegians and the Finns, they're very much outdoor people, you know, and you have four seasons and they're out the whole time, if it's cross-country skiing or going up a mountain or this kind of thing.
And they start young in school, don't they? They have the outdoor classrooms.
Literally, there are schools, I think there are schools here in Ireland as well that are almost permanently outdoors, but they have this saying in all the Scandinavian languages that there's no such thing as bad weather, there's only bad clothes. Mm. And they'll go out in literally anything. And the first time I was there in 1996, like, and my father-in-law was laughing at the shoes I had on, you know, because you're not going to last in those things. Actually, there was a young man who came over to study from UCD here in Dublin down the road. And my wife looked at his winter jacket and goes, if you go out in that for more than 15 minutes, you're not coming back, you know. So you kind of have to learn all those things. But they sort of take advantage of it then, you know. There's an awful lot of, you'll see people on Instagram and that kind of thing doing the ice swimming and that, which is very good for blood circulation and that kind of thing this kind of year. So they're very conscious of those things, and these debates are sort of constantly ongoing. Now, one of the ways that they have to deal with the weather, of course, driving in Sweden and in Scandinavia can be very, very difficult.
Let's go back to the corvids for a moment, because this is something that came up several times. We know that corvids are very intelligent birds, the crow family, and we've seen a story similar to this back in the Netherlands, must be 5 or 10 years ago. I know we talked about it on the show. Richard, what do you think?
Yes, crows are extremely intelligent. I wonder about the discrimination. If they start putting things into the yolk that aren't butts, will they still get rewarded? reward, and how do you manage to make the crows only deliver butts from cigarettes?
You can imagine them sort of delivering stones and this kind of thing as well. As far as I know, the original system was an infrared thing, so anything that they dropped in there at all that sort of passed by popped the trees out, like, you know, that sort of. And but as far as I know, the guys who were running the company, they were based on one side of the city, but most of their testing was done in a certain part of the city where they had a large corvid population, and they were saying that they were very pleased with the results of the trash that was being dropped in there.
But the thing is that the corvids weren't told that the company had gone bankrupt, so were they still doing it? Were they still doing it and getting nothing? Were they getting a strike now and saying, we're not getting anything? I mean, how could you unteach them? Because, okay, don't do it anymore, lads, you're not getting any pay. Or did it take long for them to cop on, this is a waste of time?
Do you know, they're as quick to unlearn as they are to learn, you know. So there was a pile of cigarette butts by one of those bins one day, and then the lads just went, okay, we're out of business here, there'll be no more of that, you know.
Well, was it the crows that caused the bankruptcy?
I don't think so, because I think they were, you know, I don't think they ever unionised or that kind of thing, you know, so there wasn't the expense.
I wouldn't put it past them, they're smart animals.
That's the point that kind of sparks the debate here now. They are intelligent creatures, very.
They are, and actually you mentioned the idea of unionising there. Perhaps they did to a degree. They do pass this knowledge on to their friends and family, and I use those words deliberately because we know that crows have these strong family bonds. They also have best friends, they have enemies. We know also that they're altruistic. They will also care for their niece and nephews.
Yeah. What do you mean they've got enemies and best friends?
There's a huge research that's been done by a gentleman called Dr. Kevin McGowan in Cornell University in upstate New York, and he's been studying populations of American crows there for years, and he's wing tagged them, and he knows them, and he knows all the relationships between them, and all of the stuff that goes on is like a soap opera. They keep grudges. They have you know, if someone slights them, they never forget it. It's amazing.
Hang on. He's sitting there in the field looking up at the crows. Literally. And he knows if one has been slighted by another.
We're talking decades of following these crows and getting their research in. So what you ask there, literally, yes, that's what he does. And it's amazing what they found. We know that they care for their own offspring throughout their lives, but they also care for their nieces and their nephews, which is very rare in the avian world. But also they do have enemies, and there's ones that will gang up on others, and there's other ones that have these grudges. And they are also able to identify different humans.
Yeah, you said something last week on the programme, which I meant to come back to and I completely forgot. You said that people think that birds should be friends.
Yes.
But they're not. That's kind of dog-eat-dog, yes, the world they live in.
We get this a lot when people see birds in their gardens.
And yet you're now telling me that crows have friends.
Other crows. But the thing is that people see birds in their garden fighting over the bird table or the berries on the tree or something and thinking, oh, you know, why won't that robin let the blue tit have a look in? Or why is that mistle thrush not allowing the blackbird to come next to the tree? The fact is, it's best for those birds if the other ones die. It's not in their interest to have the other birds survive. They're competition. They're not trying to help each other. They're trying to survive for themselves.
But don't they also learn by observing other things' behaviour? I remember when we had the blue tits drinking the milk and the magpies learned it. Now, the magpies actually stood on the milk bottles and poked their beaks in, knocked over the milk bottles, wrecked the place. Mm-hmm. And I used to give out to the milkman asking, was he flinging the bottles from the gate because they were all broken? And then, of course, they homogenised the milk and that was the end. But then magpies had observed the blue tits doing it.
Yeah, but the blue tits were taking the tin foil,
pecking the tin foil
and taking the cream off the top of the
and that's
milk.
What the crows tried to do. That's what the magpies tried to do. Yeah. But when they perched on the bottles fell over because one is kind of a bit bigger than t'other, and their big bills went and they wrecked the thing. The milkman used to say, it's them bloody magpies, and I'm getting blamed for firing the bottles from the gate into your house and broken on the doorstep. But anyway, that went away. There was a trait in the blue tits that were able to do it, passed it on to each other genetically. The magpies observed and learnt. There were two different things.
I genuinely would be surprised if it was genetically, because it evolved only just a very short period of time and didn't last for more than a decade or two. It was a very short-lived thing. So I don't see how natural selection could have acted on it that quickly. I'm certain, though, they learned it through observation. And we do know that it rippled out from a certain place in England where this happened, and it sort of spread.
This is the blue tits.
Yeah. I'm sure with the magpies, it definitely would be observation. They may have even evolved it independently. You know, those shiny metal foil lids that were on the milk bottles, they're kind of interesting to look at. They'd be investigating those. One might have found that there's food in here potentially. And we know with the crows that they will talk to each other. They have some way of vocally communicating. So I wouldn't be surprised at all in the Swedish example if people were, you know, I said people, I think of those people, if crows were actually telling their flock mates there's an easy way to get some food here.
Have they mobile phones there yet?
I was just wondering, I mean, if we said they're so clever, I need to go back through that bankruptcy thing and see who sued who there to see, you know, because it sounds like they may have had a hand in that as well.
Stage a hostile takeover of the company now.
Well, the only way the genetic thing would work is over several, many generations, really. And this would imply that those that drank the milk did better, sufficiently better in reproducing than the ones that didn't.
Well, it would be a form of food for them in the wintertime. So if blue tits are short of food and the little small birds and have to last long nights, the extra bit of food would give the ones an advantage that were it able would. To do it. And then they would survive rather than the ones that didn't.
And that trait then would be the trait to take milk from milk bottles would be a promulgated, but it's hard to believe it would happen that quickly.
And the second story has to do with edible road salt, Philip.
Yeah, so there was a story that came out and it made its way around the world. And sometimes these stories, they make their way around the world and then they come back to me where I am in Sweden.
Yep.
And this was to do with salt that was created from beet. And the idea being that there's 100,000 kilometres of road in Sweden and every year it gets ice and snow. Now, up in the very north of the country, of course, it'll be very icy, very snowy. Down towards the south, it'll be much more like an Irish climate maybe during the winter. But that's a whole lot of road that you have to deal with. And they obviously have to keep that clear for trucks and for various kinds of traffic. So the story went around anyway that beet-based salt had been created, a replacement for salt had been created, and that was being used to keep the roads clear. But unfortunately, when I dug into it, that appeared to be untrue. But what I did find out was that the salt that they use, like regular salt that they use on the roads, was attracting animals from the forest because it's hard for them to get salt into their diet. So they're coming onto the road and they're actually creating danger for people by being out on these frozen roads. And I found that fascinating because the question I was asking was, if the salt wasn't on the roads, where would they be getting that from in their diet? Because obviously they'd need it as well.
So this is not just birds, this is bigger animals.
No, so this would be deer and this would be elk and reindeer and that kind of thing. Big animals coming out on the road. And actually a Dublin man, when I started to look at this story, a couple of days later, he drove into one and wrote off his car because these are sizable animals.
Oh, they are. You wouldn't want to be colliding with them. So yeah, anything that attracts them onto the roads more than normal would be very unwelcome. And yeah, lots of animals, including ourselves and all mammals, need salt in their diet. And birds need a lot less salt than we do because they have a much better sort of water circulation system. They're far more efficient in the use of water. But mammals need it. And a lot of, in sort of wild conditions, a lot of mammals would go to salt licks. So a place where there's rock salt exposed, you will see them doing that. They're essentially, what was happening in Sweden, they were using the roads as salt licks. And that's what's going on there.
And particularly the animals that he was saying, like the deer and the elk, I mean, they're all herbivores, so they're plant eating.
Yeah.
So that there's no salt in that. I mean, if you're a carnivore, well, then you're eating another animal which will have salty blood and whatever. Mm-hmm. So your requirement for salt won't be as great as those big plant-eating creatures that are on the road licking it.
And you will find
their tongues not stick to the road.
But, and some plants do have salt in them more than others. So if you look at something like samphire, salicornia, that's a very salty tasting plant to the extent that humans can taste it. There's other ones that have that sodium chloride in smaller concentrations. Mm. But yeah, it's obviously far, far easier for them to get to go to the road and lick it. But then of course that has the knock-on effect of leading to more accidents. So it's a big problem. I was interested in this story because they're talking about it being some sort of alternative salt, but sodium chloride is sodium chloride. There's no alternative.
Kind of hard, isn't it?
Yeah, so it was kind of a strange kind of story that they found there. So something else could, I suppose, be used that would also melt ice or would change the melting point temperature of ice, and so that it would keep the roads clear. In Ireland we use a lot of grit to give more traction. But then one of the effects of salt on roads is it can have a big effect on plant communities because a lot of those plants by the roadside, they're not salt tolerant. They're not.
And then the salt in Ireland rains sometimes. And the salt melts and it's whooshed in. I mean, we use salt. It comes from Spain. It comes from a place in Spain called Torrevecchio, which is in Alicante on the eastern side of Spain. I was over there one year on holidays and they had it all dried up in great big mountains of it, like the way you'd have gravel and sand here in Ireland. These were mountains of salt, which from the sea they dried it out, and this was being sent over to Ireland to go on the roads. And of course, sometimes the years go past and we don't salt the roads at all. And then there's a hard frost and snow, and then the councils don't have any salt and they're all given out because they haven't got any salt, even though they didn't need it for the previous 6 years. Mm. You know, so damned if you do spend money on salting, you don't need it. Damned if you don't when you need it. Whereas you always need it every year in Sweden.
Well, that's it. There's always going to be a time when you need it. Now, they do try to use it very sparingly. And again, that's back to the environmental aspect of it, because it will leach off the road into the surrounding water table and that kind of thing, you know. But they mostly try to use sand. But what they told me was that the Trafikverket, which is basically the roads authority there, were saying that they have tried alternatives. So they have found things that work in the same way to sodium chloride, and not sodium chloride, but they work in the same way, but it's up to 20 times more expensive.
Yes.
And that brings up the question of, okay, so they try to use as little salt as possible from an environmental perspective, but they have to have something, because in the far north of Sweden, there was actually an accident there, I think it was in November or maybe early December, Where there was a bunch of Erasmus students on a bus away up in the north of Sweden. And it doesn't matter how good your winter tires are or if they're studded or chained or that kind of thing. Sometimes you're just not going to get a grip on the road. If you get that sort of black ice, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't matter. And I've been caught in it once or twice myself where the wheels are just spinning and you're going nowhere. And you just have to wait until the car comes to a stop, you know. But one of the things that they do when you're learning to drive over there, and I never sort of saw this in my time driving in Ireland, was that they actually educate you about wild animals and how they behave. And there's a whole set of laws around that. So if I see a wild animal on a road, on a motorway now, for instance, I have to call the police and I have to tell them. And if I see one going, like if an animal is hit at all, if it gets struck by a vehicle at all, you're legally obliged. You can't drive away. It's like a hit and run with a person. You can't drive away. And you also have to mark the spot, because now you're the experts here. So these animals tend to take the same paths, apparently.
Yes.
So you would have to mark the spot, and everybody has to have a brightly coloured tape in their car that you can tie around the branch of a tree. So if they find a place where there's no fencing, and there's a lot of fencing on the side of main arterial routes where they go from one side of the road to the other, you have to mark that spot, because there's a very good chance that if they've crossed there at dawn, that when they come at dusk, that they might be going back the exact same route and somebody else might meet them.
It's like I find here in Ireland occasionally, where I live in County Wicklow, you see these sika deer crossing the road.
Exactly.
And they run out as often at night. It's quite frightening when it happens, but when I see that happening, I often will just stop, safe, or pull over, because often after there's one, another four or five will come a few seconds later, and you just have to be really careful of that. It's often not the first one you hit, it's the third or the fourth.
Exactly. And you're actually told that. So there's a part of the Swedish sort of driving education when you're doing your driver's license, and it's called risk education, and it's all to do with everything from how you pack the boot of your car, you know, and you know, if you were to put a crate of beer in there, sure, that could come through the back seat if it's not correctly anchored. But the place I did mine in just in northern Stockholm, about 10 kilometres north of the city there, and you get to drive in these icy conditions, but they had a big Volvo station wagon that had hit an elk in the north of the country. I have never seen anything like the size of the animal. And they've sort of positioned it as it was in the accident, because if you hit those things, they're quite tall. You don't really realise how tall they are.
Huge, yeah.
And the bonnet of the car basically swept the legs of the elk, and the body of the elk hit the Volvo, and there's very little left of it. It's basically crushed, because I don't know what they would weigh now, but they'd weigh a good few hundred kilograms.
Oh, they're enormous, especially the big bulls with the antlers.
Yeah, yeah.
They're enormous animals. Like,
are they the same as moose now, or are they different?
Yeah, so moose is sort of a North American term for them. They tend to be called elk within Europe. And confusingly, in North America, when they talk about elk, they're talking about an animal that's very like our red deer.
Yeah.
So it's very confusing the way they use the different words. Just like we call them the other type of deer, the reindeer, they call them the caribou in North America.
Yeah.
It's important to notice the change. This is difficult, this thing. But the moose, which in America, which is the elk to the Swedes, is the largest deer of all. Mm. It is an enormous creature.
Yeah.
They should call the one in America the wapiti, wapiti. Because when you meet them first, they're much, much bigger than red deer are. Yeah. I remember camping in the Rockies with my youngest child, and these fellas used to walk through right beside, and this little fella would go over, almost touching them, and they would pay no notice to him. But they were they're extraordinary characters. And you have both of them in it's hard. There's no old and new world up there.
No.
Because they're joined by the ice. We think of us being very much separated from America.
Yeah.
But in Sweden and Finland and Norway, it isn't. That's just a little further north, and you're there, you know.
That's it.
So it's a complete change of mindset, really, their world.
So they're all wild animals.
All wild animals.
Whereas the reindeer are not. The reindeer are owned by herders.
There's a little bit of both. So there are
the
wild reindeer
as
that,
well,
and then
yeah.
there's wild boar as well. Mm-hmm. But in the north of Sweden, Finland, Norway, you have what are called the Sami people, and they would be the indigenous people up there. And they're going back hundreds, if not thousands of years. Their thing would be reindeer herding. Now, the problem with that is you come, modern industry starts to happen. You have mines in the northern part of Sweden. There's all sorts of hydroelectric and this kind of thing. But they migrate with the reindeer from season to season to season. And sometimes you might have a dam built somewhere for hydroelectric energy, or you might have a factory built or a data centre or something like that. And the rights of these indigenous farmers and the rights of people to build data centres and to do other forms of commercial enterprise. And there's a constant clash of cultures going on over that, because their reindeer farming, if you like, has been the same for generations, and they go from these particular lands. And again, like we mentioned with the tape, you know, the animals like to go to the same places. They don't like their roots to be changed.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned about the Sami reindeer herders because, as it just happens by sheer coincidence, on Christmas Day at 3 p.m. on RT Radio 1, Derek and I are presenting a radio documentary about exactly that. We travelled to Arctic Norway, met with Sami reindeer herders, we're following the story of the reindeers. The documentary is all about reindeers. If people want to find out more about that on Christmas Day at 3 p.m, they can. It's really very timely.
But have you and Derek burst the fake news about reindeer?
Do ask, I'm sure. What do you mean?
Well, Santi has reindeer, as we all know. Mm-hmm. They come and we see pictures of them every night and we see them and we know what they're going on. They all have antlers, horns, whatever you call the things on top of their heads.
Antlers,
right, yeah. But Santi's reindeer are all women. They're all female.
Yes, we do talk about that at the very top of the programme. Well, the males drop the antlers in around October and the females keep them on.
So Rudolph and all of the other reindeer, they're all female. All of the other reindeer.
I think it's fair
to say.
They're all women
because they have antlers. And what's wrong with that?
Nothing.
Why is that person anyone's bubble? I mean, it's just the lies all these years.
You want to change his name.
I didn't say anything about changing his name. So my name is Aina, and more men are called Aina than women. Rudolph can be a woman. I didn't say anything. I put words in me, God, I didn't put
You're
in.
Right, Aina.
Santi has female reindeer. Yep. You heard it here.
Okay.
It's not fake.
Well,
news.
We should explain it clearly and slowly. So off you go, Aina. You explain it exactly. Now come closer to the microphone. Not that you need to, but come
Well, we always see pictures of Santi coming on his sleigh and his reindeers, and indeed.
Which he does, yeah.
Well, I didn't, yeah. But
yeah,
the thing is that the thing is, it's Rudolph and all of the other reindeers, which when you say it quickly in Dublinese, it's all of. But there's Prancer and Dancer, and these are all just names that are supposed to be Blixen and Donham and whatever else. We don't speak those languages, so they could be male or female as far as we know. But it was like, the thing is that they're all female because male reindeer and female reindeer have antlers, both of them. Our deer in Ireland, the males have the antlers, but the females don't. And the males have their antlers and they fight with each other and they throw shapes and they have the rut. And when that's all over, they lose their antlers for they don't need them anymore. And similarly with the reindeer, the males do all their fighting. They lose their antlers before Christmas because they've won the battle and they have the women and all is grand. But the women hold on to their antlers until after Christmas because they need the calcium because they're having babies and all that sort of thing. And it's a different setup with them. So if on Christmas night, Santi is going round with a sleigh, which he is, with reindeer, which he is, with antlers, which they have. They have to be female because the males have all lost theirs. And you never see Santi with reindeer with no antlers. So Santi's reindeer are all female. Now, what's wrong with that? So
I can't believe I'm only learning this now. And all the time I spent up in Scandinavia.
I never thought about it.
And I always had a great difficulty. And when I'm coming in and speaking to people like yourselves, because as my father-in-law describes me, I'm a child of the concrete, right? I'm not a child of the forest at all. So I have awful difficulty telling the difference between certain birds and animals and that kind of thing. And I often wondered how I would tell the difference between males and females. Now, there's another child of the concrete, Alan Dalton, who's a great bird watcher and a great nature fan, who has a great podcast over in Sweden, actually. And he just records the sound of birds, migrating birds, and often goes up to the north of Sweden for days on end recording these things, you know. And he can tell, you know, by the sound of these things or by the look of them, you know, and fish and all these kinds of things, you know. So if he can learn it.
Well, it's hard to tell the difference between sexes and birds unless, and like the mallard, like the duck, they're two completely different looking birds.
Yeah. Some birds you have different plumages, some you have identical plumages. The one that's probably one of the hardest to tell of all is the robin, the European robin that we all know from our gardens, because one of the rules of thumb within Europe is that if you see a bird singing, it's going to be a male. That's the way it is most in Europe. Not all around the world, but mostly in Europe. But with the robin, both the male and the female sing, they look absolutely identical. You literally cannot tell from looking at one if it's male or if it's female. We also know with the swift.
And the robins don't know either.
Yes, that's true.
If a female comes into a garden where the male is busy singing,
they're often surprised.
No, he beats her up and hooshes her out. And she doesn't fight back. And then the man is all confused and eventually it dawns on him. But once the love life is over, once they've had their babies, once the babies can't even have red feathers or daddy wouldn't like them, he boots them all out again. That's it. And then he doesn't even get the same wife next year. He may or he may not. But it's certainly, you know, I mean, what they're doing on Christmas cards, season of happiness and goodwill, when they beat the tar out of each other, I do not know.
Well, we know with the swifts, one of my favourite birds, these are the amazing creatures that spend most of their lives in the sky. But sometimes during the breeding season, especially, if there's very bad weather, they will sometimes roost by going into nesting boxes or gaps in trees or cliffs. And what happens is when they go in there, it's often a male would be holding that sort of as his territory. And then if a female comes into that space, she'll give a call and then he all of a sudden realises, oh, you're a female. Okay, the only way you can tell is by that call that she makes. If a male then comes in, generally he won't call. Because if he did, he'd give himself away straight away. So not knowing, then the sort of dominant male will just sort of say, well, you may be a female. Okay, you can stay. That's kind of cool.
But these birds are not in two sexes in the winter, a lot of them. Robins, the gonads shrink to such an extent. They become kind of neutral. They're not sexual anymore. And remember, we're all females anyway. Becoming a male is a freak thing, really. So I don't know, but it's a very strange thing.
It's the opposite in birds. So with mammals, it's the female that's the default. With birds, it's the male that's true. The default, the different chromosomes.
Yeah.
Well, what it is, here you have X and Y chromosomes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so
two X is a female.
Two X is a female. One X, Y is a male.
In the mammals.
Yeah. So with the birds, it's different chromosomes. So they're X and Y. They're different genetically. Mm-hmm. But it's when you have the pair together that makes the male, and it's the two different ones that make the female.
Yes, and we have nipples, for instance, us males, you know, and things like that.
Well, put them away, really. I don't want to
see. I know, and speaking of which,
because that's because we are basically female. As the infant develops, or the embryo develops, then it becomes a male, decides to become male. So it's we're closer than we think, Anna, you and I, despite all the quarrels we have.
We were talking about robins last week singing, and I had three singing within 100 metres coming out of my housing estate. And I also heard a great tit singing yesterday morning, like full teacher, full on. I thought, is it spring?
Well, sometimes the birds can be tricked into thinking it is. It depends a little bit on the temperature and the light levels.
It's been very much warmer than for the point of time. It was 6 degrees warmer at some stages. It's been 15, 16 degrees a couple of
times. It fluctuates
at the end of November
lot.
And December. So, I mean, hedgehogs, people are still seeing them. They haven't gone into hibernation.
Yep.
And frogs, and they should all be in hibernation. It's the temperature drop that puts them into hibernation, and it hasn't been cold enough.
And with the birds, it's also the big component of the light there. And often in urban and suburban areas, light pollution can trigger that. It triggers the hormones in the bird that thinks it's springtime.
Okay, now, but it wasn't. It was during the day.
Yeah, well, but still, it's in that
mode. So nothing to do with the light pollution at all.
He's just getting his spake in early.
No, but I was surprised. I mean, it was full blast.
We also know they do practice.
It's not about breeding. It's about territory. It's a good idea to start asserting your rights over an area long before it's really going to matter. So that great tit, he's onto something.
Anna always makes a phone call before she comes in. Asserting her territorial rights. Anyway, well, talk to us about the great moose migration.
This is one of those amazing things for people like ourselves involved in media. You know, people say the television is dead and that, oh, you know, you need to give them something every 10 seconds to keep them into. No. One of the biggest television programmes in Sweden at the moment is the Great Moose Migration, or the Great Elk Migration. And it's what they call, I love this term, slow TV, right? TV where very little happens. And basically, they follow the moose and the elk as they migrate across the countryside, and they just show you what they're doing. Now, an awful lot of this is shown on linear television, so you can sit down, you can put it on for 10 or 12 hours, and you can just watch these huge animals. They call them the king of the forest in Swedish, and you can see these moose just moving. But there's also a thing where you can watch online, and the equivalent of the RTE player, for instance, and you'll watch that. And there's a chat alongside it. And people are sitting there, you know, people who might be, you know, not working that day, or people who might be, they might have retired. And they're chatting away exactly as we're chatting here about animals and their habits and about nature. And a study was done by a researcher in the University of Uppsala that found that viewers of this show are much happier and they're much more relaxed than the people who don't actually watch it. And part of it is because of that idea of sort of communing with nature. Now, we spoke earlier on about how the Scandinavians are very much outdoor people. The Nordic people are very much outdoor people. But like everywhere else, if you have an iPad and you have, you know, streaming service and that kind of thing, you know, your motivation to go out gets reduced more and more, you know. Now, one of the things we haven't really spoken about is the effect of climate change on Sweden now. So when I went to Sweden first in 1996, I mean, there would have been feet of snow when I arrived at Arlanda Airport. That's not the case
anymore.
Is
it that noticeable?
It is, yeah. Okay. So there's a lot of what they call green Christmases now around Stockholm.
Oh,
so
that's not nice.
Not really.
Not if you live in that part of the world, you want something else.
And it is very dark. So, I mean, the great hit would have serious problems working out what was day and what was night. You know, sometimes the sun doesn't really sort of break through at all. So it'd be cloudy the whole day. It'll just be grey and miserable, and it'll just be dark and miserable from there. So, well, when this great elk migration happens, you know, I think it's twice a year that they have it, but there's one in particular that they show.
They come and they go.
They come and they go. And and this is the hard thing. It's very hard to direct the stars of this particular show because they don't care what you want on television, you know. But they will. The camera crews will follow with them. And then they have stationary cameras that are placed out along the routes that they take. And it's magnificent to think that them, and, you know, obviously other animals will make cameo appearances there as well. You'll get birds looking
at
the
cameras. They haven't managed to stick a camera on the antlers of any of these so that they would themselves cause record their migration.
Not that I've seen, but I'd
you
imagine.
Suggest that. I won't charge much for this. That's probably.
You can be a consultant on next year's long running series of these things. But it is amazing.
It's a good
to
idea,
see.
Ain't it? In fairness,
it really is. I mean, I'd imagine Netflix would be ringing on your doorbell now, seeing if we can do a similar thing in Ireland. But it's incredible to see when you think that, you know, short form video, you know, if you go back to Vine and 6 second videos and that kind of thing, that was the thing. And now all of a sudden it seems to be like an hourglass where you either do really short form stuff of between 10 seconds and maybe a minute, and this stuff that goes on for hours.
Well, can
end.
I tell you that the slow television movement, as it's known, started in 2009 in Norway. A train journey I've made lots of times, the Bergen Line, 6.5 hours across the country. And they put a camera at the front of the train and they recorded that and they stuck it on TV and the world and its granny watched it. They got millions of viewers in prime time. They couldn't believe it. But actually, slow television started right here in this programme in the year 2000.
Yeah, with Jackie and Daw.
Jackie and Daw, the first brood of the millennium, when we put cameras on Jackdaw's Nest in County Kildare with a company called Wild Ireland at the time. And we won an award in Germany called the Prix Europafront. But we put it on all day long. It was not on TV. I tried to get our colleagues in telly to put it on and they wouldn't. But I did my best to say, just put this thing out there. I guarantee you people watch. People
were
watching.
We streamed it.
And we got thousands and thousands and thousands of people watching it. So there is an interest there. It doesn't have to be all fancy and dancing and everything else. But anyway, elk and moose. Can somebody tell me what the difference is?
Yeah, so if from a European point of view, they're the same thing. So the animal that's called the elk in Europe, and that's based from Scandinavian languages, of Nordic origin, that's the biggest deer in the world, as Richard was saying there earlier. And it's got these huge big antlers. In North America, the same species is found there, but it's called the moose there.
But they call this the great moose migration.
But that's because people often would think that should be the translation. Everything's become very Americanized.
Right, okay.
You notice this.
We speak American here all
no,
the time.
No, but I was wondering why, if it's called the elk in Sweden, why they're calling it on TV the great moose migration for their own viewers.
I think it's the alliteration there of moose and migration.
But I suppose moose is unambiguous. So the moose clearly just refers to that species. So we understand that. The word elk is used for different species of deer in North America. It's for a relative of the red deer called the wapiti, which is there, like a bigger, chunkier red deer. And it's a mighty animal, a very, very large deer indeed, but not as big as a moose or an elk in Europe. So it's the same name used for two different creatures, and moose is the only one that's unambiguous. So maybe that's another reason they went for it.
And as you were saying, the Swedish word for elk is elg, which is A, it's the A with the two dots, LG, and it's similar in Norwegian, Danish. The three languages are quite similar, you know.
So that's even the reindeer in America is called a caribou. Mm-hmm. I mean, does Santi have caribou when he's in America?
You'd wonder, wouldn't you?
No, he doesn't. He has reindeer.
The interesting thing about the palm, are we going to call it the moose or the elk? The one with the palms, the big palmate antlers. It is a relative of the giant Irish deer, which has gone, in a sense, our Irish deer, long ago, gone 10,000 years now, was a relative of theirs. And of course, the fallow deer is actually a relative of theirs now. But there's this great division between those that have big palmate kind of antlers and those which have kind of tree-like branched antlers, like the red deer.
Hat stands.
Yes.
I was driving in, there's an island between Sweden and Finland called Åland, and it's a Finnish protectorate, but it's Swedish speaking. And I was driving there one summer, and it was late in the evening, about 9 o'clock. Now, it doesn't get dark in that part of the world at all at that time of the year. And the next thing, this animal came out from the left-hand side of the road, and it was the single biggest thing I've ever seen. And the antlers made it about three times as big. It was almost like science fiction, because you hear of these things, and you see, but then when you actually see them in the wild, it's absolutely incredible to see them. And it came out, and sometimes you hear about, you know, wild animals and that they don't really want to be dealing with human beings. They don't want to. And this guy had no problem. Assuming it was a guy given the time of the year, but he just came wandering out. He looked at the car, wasn't bothered one bit by it. Wandered, like he wasn't going to be, you weren't going to be rushing him, you weren't going to be hurrying him up or anything. Wandered into the other side of the forest, and then he was gone. But he was also very pale, almost white. And I was thinking that that's probably not the best now when it comes to hunting season, because he might stick out against the trees. But apparently, they are quite rare to have that kind of colour on their coat, you know.
Yeah, these kind of aberrations can happen, but as you said, yes, natural selection will often go against them, and they don't tend to live very long or pass their genes on in the modern era because they're hunted by people, but also they're much more visible to things like wolves and other predators that would go for them as well. So that can be, yeah, that can be a big issue for animals.
Certainly, when we did the rat documentary and I went over to Canada, I was over in Alberta doing the place where there's no rats, the only place in the world where there are no rats. But after that, we went up into the Rockies and we were in Jasper, a place up town up there for skiing and whatever, and parked the car off to do something. And when we came back, there was this great big moose with antlers in the car park. He wasn't even in the wild, eating the bush. There was some bush behind the car, the rented car we had, and there it was eating everything. God, I'm not getting into that car till it goes away. Huge big thing. So they are enormous. And this one didn't care at all about a car park. That was the place where there was extra food, if it looked like something that it had decided was a good place to visit. Yeah. And nobody was going near it, I'll tell you that much.
We have that. My father-in-law lives on the edge of a forest, and where I live in the suburb of Stockholm in Sweden, there's actually a green area called Järvafältet, the Järva field, and they're not allowed to build on that, right? That's one of these things. And it's prime sort of real estate, you know, because it's only 10, 15 minutes from the city, you know. But this is the lungs of Stockholm, really. And we have it, it's probably about 400 metres from my house is where you get to the very edge of it. Mm. But that means then that we have a lot of wild animals living there, and we do have deer coming. So previously when it would be very cold and there would be a lot of snow and a lot of the food on the ground would be covered, they'd come into our gardens and they'd eat whatever shoots and bits and pieces they could find. Now they don't have to do that. Like, so the weather has sort of allowed them to stay in their more natural habitat and to stay away from human beings, which it also gets sort of wild hares and that kind of thing. You'll see them all over.
Do they get drunk? I mean, there used to be stories of them getting drunk eating fermented fruits.
Yeah, so in August and September, when the apple harvest happens, right, so the apples naturally fall from the
trees. Is this an urban legend now?
No, this is the real deal. So if you go out onto social media and you put it in there, you will find that they've been through, so they eat the rotting apples, right, and then they ferment in their stomach and they do get drunk, and you will see moose, because as I say, very tall creatures, very long legs, and the legs are just gone from under them, and you'll see them sort of barreling around the place, you know, their horns flying, that kind of thing, and eventually just lying down because they can't move anymore.
There was a young lady from Ryde who ate 99 apples and died. The apples fermented inside the lamented, making cider inside her inside.
She didn't happen to be an elk or a moose.
Could have been.
Look, deer are nutcases. They're cracked. they produce these enormous antlers every year, and they drop them, and then they have to produce a new set, and it's an enormous cost to them. If you go to Africa, there are antelope, which look just like deer, but they're actually related to cows. They're only distant relatives of deer, but to us they seem to be deer. But they keep their antlers throughout the year, and they don't incur these enormous costs. The great Irish deer perished simply because he couldn't pay the bill for these enormous... Think of the amount of stuff you must eat, must manage to secure in order to develop these giant antlers.
Yeah,
why not hold on to them?
Yeah, but the Irish deer at the time, they were in a tundra region, and then the climate change was happening quickly. We turned to forestry, so we had less grasses for them to eat, and then their huge big antlers were getting stuck in the forest, in the trees and this sort of thing. So it wasn't so much. It was climate change, and they were on an island, so they couldn't actually walk away. I mean, that's why we wouldn't have a great big migration of moose in Ireland, because where would you go when you got to Antrim, or where would you go when you got to Kerry? So that was the trouble with those. So if they had been able to walk away from Ireland to go up north, then they would have survived, but they weren't. So that was the end of those particular animals.
But it comes down to sexual selection in those deer. So the thing is that the males with the biggest antlers, they're the most impressive to those females. And as we've already established, it's within the deer, it's only the reindeer or the caribou that where both the males and the females have antlers. With the other deer species, it's just the males. And those males that have invested all of those resources in their bodies into producing those massive antlers, then shedding them and growing bigger ones again the following year, they're going to do best with the females. They're going to then father more of the offspring in the next generation. And when it gets to that point, longevity doesn't really matter in terms of evolutionary success. It's the number of offspring they leave behind. Yeah. So they might live fast and die young, but they're more successful because they pass those genes on. Yeah. So that's the trade-off. It's like the peacock's tail. It's to the detriment of the male, but the females find that attractive. So the males with the biggest and best and brightest tails, they've invested most resources into it in their bodies. They then father more offspring, and their genes are the ones that then create the next generation, and their lineage lives on. So that's really what it's about. So it is eventually those animals, yeah, it will come to a point where the deer suffer and even die because of their antlers, but they're still the winners in the evolutionary game.
There's two kinds of displays in nature. One is called the handicap display, and the other is different. The handicap display is the sort of thing deers do. It's producing something that is utterly ridiculous in itself, because it gives you a ticket and have access to females. Other displays, I mean, say if I go out and show my biceps to a suitable ladies to say, look,
biceps, that what you're showing now.
Biceps are still useful. I don't deplete them in showing them. Do you see? But if I am a deer and I have these enormous blooming antlers, I've gone to so much trouble. I mean, it's like the fellow with the big car, you know, he's spent all his money on the car and that he's to impress the ladies. And she's fooled by this, that he's worthy.
Does it matter if it works?
Huh?
does it matter if it works?
Well, why should it work?
Well, it doesn't matter.
Why shouldn't people?
If it works, it works.
Why don't the females cop on that this bloody big antler thing and the peacock's tail and all that is really a diversion from his true work?
Women are easily impressed. Surely, if they've produced very large antlers, they are successful.
Mm. Yeah. So they are, but why should that be the badge of success?
Because she's going to, her male offspring will inherit that trait, successful. And then they will have more offspring, and
she's
her grandchildren,
not just thinking
great
of the male offspring. She's probably thinking of her offspring generally.
Well, they will have the same sort of. He also has strong genetic fitness. But it's called the sexy son hypothesis.
And if you look at a guy and he's driving a big car and he's done really well, or if there's a guy looking at a woman and she's driving a big car and you think they've done really well, they're fairly bright. They've got to the top of the pile. That's what it implies.
They've managed to convince the bank manager to give them the money to waste.
And they don't notice it because you're not looking.
I'm just saying.
The revealing display is much better. The revealing display is much better.
You can't go around revealing yourself,
Richard. They may be compensating for something, Derek.
Most animals, my friends, the swans, for instance, are revealers. They show their great power, but they don't deplete it in showing it. They don't waste at all in this sort of thing. They really do need the strength and weight that they have, and they reveal it. And that is a much better guide to who will be a successful father than having a huge...
How do you judge success?
Hmm? And the number of offspring.
That's success.
Not just that.
It's having more offspring that themselves will survive.
You won't say that, Derek.
Well, because I don't have any offspring, you know, that's a failure. Is that what you would consider now, Richard?
Well, evolutionary-wise, yeah.
It's a fairly harsh judgment.
You become extinct if you don't reproduce.
So all the stuff
that went into making you...
They throw stuff at you, huh?
All the stuff, all the wonderful genes and genetic and all that went into making you... You become extinct if you don't pass on. So that's how you become
a
mortal.
They just decided they couldn't recreate it, Aidan.
One of a kind.
But about the cars, if you don't notice the cars going by because you weren't looking, the ones that really want attention soup up the engine so they have the noise of the thing. Is that so? You can see these cars all
they
souped
put
up.
The car keys on the table in restaurants and cafes.
Well, that's been going on for a long time.
What restaurants do you go to, Derek?
What would the human equivalent of the revealers be in that case? Would we have that in the human world? Because, okay, you can go out there with these ostentatious displays of car keys or that, but you know, what would a revealer look like in the human world?
Gym bunnies.
Well, a sensible woman would say, well, yes, he's shrewd. He's not wasting his money on a big fancy bloody car. He's kept the money. You should take the girl down to the bank.
You see, it's very old-fashioned ideas, Richard. Would you not think that the girl might be taking him down to the bank and showing him her wares?
You should take her down and get the manager to show her your account.
Here's the bottom line.
That's what I've got. It's not out there in
Anyway, we haven't really strayed from nature. It's human nature we're discussing there. In actual fact,
we're animals like any other.
Have you done all your stories, Philip, at this stage?
Do you know what? There's one more left that I think is brilliant. Right?
We have time.
There's a couple of great jobs coming up next year in Katrineholm in Sweden. Now, I'd love to get one of them, but unfortunately, I've fallen one of the major criteria, which is I'm not a sheep. Right?
Okay.
So they're looking for...
Costumes.
I'll see how the interview goes for me, you know. But what they're looking to do is they're looking to employ, in inverted commas, 20 sheep to move them around different parts of the council's area rather than mowing lawns and using strimmers and that kind of thing. And so on the council's common land, on the various meadows and patches of grass that they have, so they want natural lawn mowers rather than going in and cutting everything to bits. And the way they found to do it is to actually rent them or to pay farmers for the labours of their sheep. And that kind of goes back to where we were at the beginning of the discussion with the corvids. It's finding these natural solutions.
Well, they're doing it here. Richard can talk about this right outside his door many years ago.
In fact,
we made a radio documentary about it.
Did we? I can't remember.
Oh, my God.
They brought the Highland cattle
onto Paddy's field in front of your house.
The beautiful Highland cattle, yeah, they brought them in.
Which they got from a farmer in County Wicklow. And you live in Malahide in North County, Dublin.
They would be the kind of thing that would do well in Sweden because it didn't matter how cold and rough it became. These fellas just ignored the beautifully hairy things. And
like myself.
And they look fearful, but myself and I used to help the farmer sometimes to herd them into vans and things. It was a wonderful thing.
But the reason they put them into the field in the first place, do you remember?
Yes, because that field had Brent geese in it, and it had to be kept cropped so that the geese won't go there if the grass is too long. So what they did was they brought these cattle in to keep it the level of grass low, and they didn't have to be taken in and housed in winter. They were strong enough to stay there all the year round. They were ideal for it, and they were beautiful animals. They attracted great attention. People used to bring their kids to see these shaggy cattle, and the cattle would come over and take unmentionable things from the children's hands.
And they were there for a couple of years. Did it work? Did the Brent geese come back?
Well, they took them away, and there are no Brent geese there now. And the thing is overgrown now. It's not.
But it was still a lovely idea.
It was a marvelous
and it was
idea.
Nice to see them. Many times I went up there and you saw these Highland cattle, most unexpected.
Did the farmers get paid for that, or did they just have to feed them somewhere?
I don't know how it got worked, but the farmers used to bring them up, certainly from Wicklow, and put them in the field. I don't think they got money, or as you were saying, were they fed in food? You know what I mean?
Yeah, they're doing it in Howth with goats as
With goats as well.
These are wild Irish goats, so they're not anybody's goats as such.
But they're doing that for a particular reason. That's to stop the gorse from burning. So they're putting the goats in, they're putting natural barriers, fire breaks in.
And the goats are wild, so nobody has to be paid for the goats, and they actually pay a herder, a goat minder, to mind the goats and move them about eating the gorse, so that the gorse then isn't a fire hazard out
there. But one of the most remarkable things...
It is a study that's going on there, so somebody, there's work, money gone into it.
Yeah. But they're being controlled by an app, which I think is amazing, because they have these collars on them, and
electronic collar,
and if there's a certain invisible line that's been set on the app, it's changed every so often, and if they try to go outside that, it triggers this electrical sensation in the neck.
I'm not sure how I feel about that aspect of it, but they say it doesn't hurt them, but I don't want to say electric shock, but it gives them something or other, and it stops them from discomfort.
So it's
an imaginary fence that's there. Yeah. It's a terrific idea. They're great stories, Philip. Thank you. But while you're here, one kind of negative story, unfortunately, from Sweden. The others were nice and light. The snowy owl has been declared regionally extinct in Sweden for the first time in 20 years. The country has officially lost a bird species. Have you ever seen a snowy owl?
I don't think I have ever seen one in the flesh. Now, I'm trying to think now if I've ever seen it. I don't think I have, but that is one of those stories that sort of came up in Sweden, because it's one of those places. This is the home of the environmental campaigner Greta Thunberg. It's one of these countries that prided itself on taking its environmental responsibility.
Sorry, would you just pronounce her name again there?
Greta Thunberg.
Okay.
And I'll tell you a funny story about
Greta. Is that the right way of pronouncing it?
That's the right way of pronouncing her name, yeah. Her mum is an opera singer, but I would have gone to a lot of her Fridays for Future protests as a journalist, and I've interviewed her many times. I've been in her house, and Greta's on the autism spectrum, and she's like, she has her ways about her, you know, certain things, like certain people, like anybody, I suppose. She never wants to be filmed when she's eating. And when she was in school, she'd be coming, she'd be eating a snack and that kind of thing, and she said, "Don't film me," and that, you know. We got to know her quite well, and I remember the first time I ever made her laugh was we had to go to her house one day, because she doesn't really trust everybody. It takes a long time to sort of build up a little bit of trust with her. And one day we were doing an interview, and I asked her, I was asking her about the themes of the particular protest. Now, I'm from Dublin, so we don't really have THs. And she's going, "Teams? What are you talking about, teams?" And, "Oh, you mean teens," she says. And I still have the audio clip. I'm never going to release it in case she gets grief over it, you know. But when you have that sort of, you know, that person there, that sort of lodestar from the environmental movement and for conservation, that kind of thing. And this is a real blow, like the snowy owl and nature and that kind of thing. It does mean a lot to Swedish people. And it doesn't matter if you're on the right politically or the left politically. Everybody in Sweden loves the environment.
No, describe it and tell us a bit about it, if you would.
So Harry Potter fans will know this already, because Hedwig the owl there was a snowy owl. It's a very, very large owl, and they're incredibly white, and they have a variable amount of black spotting on them. The females have more of spots than the males do. Like with most birds of prey, including other owl species, the females tend to be larger than the males. And obviously that white plumage that they have, that is to help them to blend in with snowy environments in tundra, in the Arctic. They're very much a northern hemisphere, very Arctic region species. They're found all around the polar regions. So you find them across Europe, Asia and North America. And I've actually seen them here in Ireland. Well, I've seen one on Arranmore Island off County Donegal. They're turning up in Ireland with increasing regularity now. Not by no means a common bird or something you would expect, but there's a couple of records usually every few years of them coming to Ireland.
How did it end up here?
Well, people think, is this a sign of a species that is doing well and expanding its range? Unfortunately, it's completely the opposite. This has been happening in Sweden as well. Climate change is affecting them so much that they're not able to exploit their normal food source. resources, and they are just out of sheer desperation trying to go somewhere else to try and find something to eat, even though it's not their optimum habitat type.
Where do they breed? Do they don't have trees, do they?
No, they breed on the ground. They breed on the ground, and they tend to be in very remote areas. It's very hard to find their nests, so people don't really uncover them that way. It's not a species that's been persecuted by humans. It's not humans that directly hunt them or anything like that. They don't have much by way of natural predators. They're very, very serious big animals. Things like Arctic foxes presumably could go for their eggs or chicks when they're very young, but that's about it. But it's really climate change. We know that the numbers of these snowy owls in Scandinavia particularly are driven by the lemming population. So they go through this boom-bust cycle of lemmings and voles as well. Yep. So every 4 or 5 years, the cycle of this, where you have all of a sudden an explosion of the lemming population, then you have a boom time for the owls. They feed very well. And then there's a few lean years after that when the lemming population drops off. All of those stories about lemmings committing suicide, for example, that's not true. It's just when the population gets to such a high level, these animals are just trying to move to new areas and just blindly go off cliffs and things like that. They don't intend to do it. It's just sheer numbers. But what's happening is these lemmings and certain types of vole, they rely on snow. They tunnel into the snow. They hide under there. Snow is what they need. And as there is less snow and less ice, there's less habitat for these because there's competition from things like mice and rats and other rodents that are less well adapted to cold weather. But they're also not as good for the snowy owls. And what's happening then is other predators, like buzzards, for example, they're able to colonise further north into the unfrozen regions. And there's more competition for the snowy owls now. There's less habitat for them. And we're seeing this a lot with a lot of these Arctic animals, also the animals at the tops of high mountains. As the range contracts, there's less and less space for them to go. And at the top of the high mountain, when your glaciers disappear and the snow disappears, well, they disappear. They can't go anywhere else. Imagine you're an animal like a chamois, like these little deer antelope that you get in the Alps. It's not like they can migrate anywhere. They don't want to be anywhere that's below tree line, anywhere that's not in the snow or the glaciers. If they melt, they just die. There's no other option. Same sort of thing, unfortunately, is happening to the snowy owls. Their range is getting closer and closer and closer to the North Pole, and eventually there's just not going to be enough habitat or food to sustain them.
But the largest falcon in the world, the jar falcon, is still in Sweden. So it's a strange thing that. But the further south you go towards the tropics, tropics are the richest place in terms of biodiversity. You get huge profusions. You're in a tropical rainforest. You can't make it up. It's so complex. But as you go north, things thin out and thin out and thin out until you get to a place like Sweden, where things are very meagre in terms of diversity. Mm. But there is a funny effect in the water. As you go north, water is able to hold more oxygen. So you get things like whale migrations up to colder seas. Mm. So there's a kind of a strange inversion inside in the water with what is going on further south, because southern waters have far less oxygen in them. But it's a funny old world.
What's the story on polar bears? I mean, polar bears, obviously, the males hunt on the ice and catch the seals through the seal holes. And if there's no ice or less ice, then it's more difficult for them to get food in the winter time. My daughter was away in Finland, not Sweden, but she was amazed that they had bear sausage on sale, like salami type sausage on sale in the supermarket.
Polar bear.
Well, I didn't.
That would be brown bear.
Well, they brown bear. They're eating brown bear.
Oh, they ate hunting up there. And hunting is shocked. A big...
Do you get bear in Swedish supermarkets as well?
So
it was very expensive and she didn't bring any home.
Yeah.
And I would have not encouraged her to be buying bear meat. But I just wondered, I mean, if it's endangered and rare, why are they eating it? And is it not very toxic? I mean, isn't the polar bear liver crammed with metals and poisons of the liver of any animal? Or did I...
The problem with polar bear livers is not the metals. It's full of... It's too much vitamin A. It's a massive overdose. So even like a spoonful sized amount of liver from a polar bear be enough to kill a person many times over because the vitamin A concentration is so high.
Just in the liver.
That's just in the liver, yeah.
Can we talk about something happy just before we say goodbye? Is there anything happy? Would you like to say anything for Christmas to the listener, Aina? Because we're going to ramp up now.
Well...
Enjoy your dinner.
Christmas is a great time. Christ Mass. It's like Christmas Eve. As you said, that's when they celebrate. But we had this idea of the Mass for Christ, Michaelmas, Candlemas. It's an old English word, this Mass. So, in fact, Christ was born on the 16th of September. But why would you spoil a good story with the facts? And it's a celebration of the winter solstice. And the days are shortest on the 22nd, then as the Neolithic peoples measured with Newgrange and places. And then the days begin to get longer. The sun is coming back. Lou hasn't abandoned us because the sun god Lou went away. You never know. I mean, the sun went lower and lower and lower in the sky. Maybe it wasn't going to come back. But it came back. They measured it going up. And they went out to the woodlands in Ireland, which were deciduous woodlands, no leaves. But the where holly and ivy shining in the low sunshine, the berries on them, and they brought them into their houses to celebrate the return of the sun 5,000 years ago with the Neolithic people, and we are still doing it. So when you bring in your holly and people are still bringing in the holly, putting it on the pudding, you are not celebrating Christmas, you are celebrating the sun god Lugh. And it's great to think that in Ireland we have customs going back 5,000 years. So cherish your holly and your ivy, because it goes back a very long time.
And I'll make sure we put a link on the website to the programme about the holly and the ivy and indeed the Christmas tree. And don't forget Santa on Christmas Eve on RT Radio 1 in the afternoon, and then on Christmas Day from 3 p.m. a wonderful documentary about the reindeer. Philip, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks so much for having
me. Safe journey back to Sweden. Aina, thank you. Thank you to Niall. Thanks to Richard. Thanks to Michelle Brown, our researcher, and Sinead Renshaw, our broadcast coordinator, and David Gibson was on sound. We want to wish you all a very happy Christmas. All right, see you later.
Bye.